Okay, welcome to the show, my friends. Today on the show, it's Thomas Morton. Thomas Morton was a ranger. He formerly tried to be a SEAL, but then he moved to become a ranger. And after 10 years or so in the military, doing some tours of duty, he decided to become a scientist, believe it or not. The only person in the world that I know that's actually retrained into biology from the military. And not only a scientist, he's actually a successful scientist and made some interesting discoveries, which we'll all find out today. So I have a lot of questions, and I know everybody here watching has probably seen me on LinkedIn, if you haven't already, basically going round and round trying to figure out what's going on with the world, and basically panicking, thinking that all of our freedoms are going to go away, but then also talking to scientists like Tom, which kind of calmed me down a little bit. So yeah, man, how you doing today, Tom?
Great. It's definitely a pleasure to be here, Nico. So I appreciate the intro. Happy to explore this topic with you. I think, one of my goals in sort of these sorts of talks is just to kind of focus on the things that are real concerns and kind of dispel the stuff that isn't useful to the conversation. So happy to be here and happy to explore this topic with you.
I'm writing a newspaper article today, and I'm advocating for an increase in knowledge of biology and genetics in the general public, because my idea is that will help the genuine concerns float to the top of the slurry pool of information and stop some of those wacky conspiracy theories getting any traction, which basically is costing us time. So
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you on that. I guess, this is most of what I'll say on this is anecdotal, just based on my own interviews with people. I think there's kind of two things at play. There's a bit of a pro and a con. I do agree with you that increasing the public's general knowledge base of, biology, ideology, all the ologies in this space is good, especially considering what we're dealing with now with this pandemic. But I have noticed a bit of a drawback that it seems like, without the proper sort of foundational knowledge base, people start learning just enough to be dangerous. And in some ways, I feel like that's adding fuel to the fire in some of the conspiracy theory stuff. I mean, I'm sure we'll kind of dive into this later, but the idea that the mRNA vaccine has the ability to, alter your DNA in some capacity, which is completely false. A lot of people believe that. I think of other stories about when it came out that, the COVID vaccine was initially tested on a cell line called HEK293s, which is a very common human cell line. People kind of took that as, they were implementing embryonic cells into the vaccine and that we were being injected with embryonic fluid, all kinds of stuff that kind of just don't make sense and aren't true. So I do think that we do need an increase in the knowledge base across the board on this, but the right knowledge for the layman.
One of the concerns that I had for the RNA vaccine is that, so for people who are not familiar with the science, RNA vaccine is goes into the cells, and then the cell has machines that look at the mRNA and churn out proteins, which are the spike protein, which is found on COVID-19. And what I was concerned was, like, okay, we're making these spike proteins, but is there any way to actually stop them being produced? Like, is this going to get produced forever? And then I actually looked at some of the an article on the source code. There's actually source code for this vaccine, and actually I could call the conspiracy theorist by a person who was pro-vaccine. He's saying, what are you talking about, all this source code? Like it's not, it is source code. There's actually scientists that actually sit down and work out this code, and they put it into the mRNA. So, but what I found out was that the scientists put these sequences of letter A's at the end of the source, and every time this ribosome machinery churns out a new spike protein, it will take off X number of A's. I don't actually know how much it takes off, but that means there'll only be a certain amount produced for each mRNA that goes into the cell, which is good news.
Yeah, so that series of A's that you're talking about is sometimes referred to as the poly-A tail, and that's at the 5' end, which signifies the end of the mRNA. Now, At least based on my understanding, that a single strand of mRNA can be translated numerous times by various ribosomes. But regardless of the role of the poly A tail in that, what I can tell you just in general is that mRNA is a very unstable molecule. So they generally break down spontaneously. Usually, you know, sometimes within days, but at most, at least within research I've been a part of, months. So this is not something that's going to persist for a very long time. You know, I don't know the specifics for this version of it. It has a lot to do with the length of the mRNA and the composition of the mRNA, but I would guess that, you know, your body's going to produce these spike proteins for probably a few weeks at most with this vaccine, and then the mRNA will spontaneously degrade, and then its base amino acids will be integrated into some other protein or mRNA. So it's mRNA vaccines are temporary in nature, and I do think that that's one of the things that is a bit of an upsell for this type of technology versus traditional ones.
Mm-hmm. We're going to get to the melted background, but I'm covering the bio stuff because it's probably most interesting to the most people. So what were you actually doing in the research of the mRNA?
Yeah, so just to clarify, I didn't have any specific research projects that dealt with the COVID vaccine. But one of the base technologies of COVID, of the COVID vaccine is mRNA engineering. And that is something I dealt with. Although I did do some mRNA engineering myself, the majority of the engineering I did was on another type of molecule called a tRNA or a transfer RNA. And without going into too much detail, just in general, a component called a ribosome is what interacts with an mRNA. But the molecules that bring the amino acids that create the chain that eventually becomes a fully fledged protein, those components are called tRNA. And the tRNA, you can kind of think of it as a lock and key. You can think of it as a lock and key that the tRNA nests within the ribosome at the particular codon, which is three nucleotides, and the tRNA specifically targets that particular sequence. And then in doing so, it deposits its amino acid in the chain that the ribosome is building, and then disengages, and then it gives space for another tRNA to come in. So I say all that to say that, although, you know, the human genome has come a long way from our single cell ancestors, you know, there's still problems with our genome, and those problems manifest in a lot of different ways. One of the ways they manifest is in a mutation or a specific type of mutation called nonsense mutations. And in a nonsense mutation, what happens is one of the nucleotide pairs gets altered or modified in a way that now where that codon should have coded for, let's say, serine, instead it codes for stop. So there's a particular triplicate there's a couple different types of triplicates that tell the ribosome to stop and then disengage. And so when those types of mutations exist, they're called nonsense mutations. And what happens in the case of a nonsense mutation is as the ribosome is building the protein, the particular protein that is related to the mRNA it's interacting with, it'll get truncated early. So one of the diseases I was looking at specifically is muscular dystrophy. And in the case of muscular dystrophy, there's a nonsense mutation which causes dystrophin to be truncated early and it's no longer functional. And that's where you get muscular hypertrophy and some other effects in humans, which ends up being fatal. So what I was able to do in my research is that I was able to engineer the tRNAs to, instead of interacting with, say, serine, one of the many amino acids, I was able to get them to interact with the stop codon and essentially trick the ribosome to keep translating. And the result of that was a fully fledged dystrophin protein that then went on to be functional. And so we could recover a lot of that protein synthesis through my techniques. So there's kind of two parts of what I was doing. I was engineering tRNAs to be able to be targeted specifically to particular mRNAs, and then also to interact with what we called PTCs, so pre-termination codon, so essentially a stop where it's not supposed to be. And then in my experiments, I would engineer mRNA to do various things. Sometimes I would either add a stop codon so I could test it in a particular protein. A lot of the proteins that we'll use in cells for testing many of the mRNAs that we'll use in cells for testing will create a fluorescent protein. So what I would do in that case is I would take that mRNA, introduce a PTC, so then we could test on it with the tRNAs that I was building. So that was really a long-winded way of saying that I have a pretty good understanding of, you know, many of the mechanisms behind the way mRNA works. And so it gives me a little bit of insight on the way that the COVID vaccines work as well.
So I could pretty much keep talking to Tom on this subject from my own curiosity for about 4 hours, because I have enough biophysics knowledge to be a bit dangerous and ask questions that are difficult. But for the purpose of this podcast, I'm going to keep targeting questions relevant to the vaccines and all that stuff. But well, I'll ask one more question on this. How many times did you do that experiment before you had a result that's worthy of publication or submitting to the next stages?
I have to give some credit here to my PI at the time, Dr. Molly, Dr. Prashant Molly. He's a brilliant guy, famous in his own right. He was one of the pioneers of CRISPR technology, which in my opinion is going to change the world, and at least in the world of bioengineering in the future, and for really everybody. But so when I joined his lab, I had some big ideas on anti-aging therapies and some other stuff. And he kind of presented the idea of what we ended up calling tRNA suppression. And it sounded amazing. And I actually couldn't believe it. No one had really studied it much. And I'll tell you what, I try not to be too dismissive of times when I'm lucky. I don't really believe in luck too much, but in this case, I really was. So really on my very first significant experiment, the guidance of some of my mentors and Dr. Molly, we had a positive result. And that really put us on a path to really developing this tRNA suppression idea. And I think it's really promising. I think it's going to be a way, much in the same way that the COVID mRNA vaccines work, and they're kind of fast to produce and really easily modified. I think that this tRNA suppression technique is going to be able to do sort of the same thing. And we're going to be able to target some pathological genetic conditions. So, you know, whereas vaccines typically target viral pathogens, now we can start fixing some of our genetic problems without going sort of the full gamut, which would be a CRISPR technique, which is permanent. And without getting into too much detail on that, the CRISPR techniques are super powerful, but the problem is they cause genomic changes, which then are hereditary. And if you mess that up one time, now, you know, your whole lineage has that same problem. So I think we're doing the right thing by kind of pumping the brakes on the CRISPR stuff for a little bit. And in the meantime, looking for other ways that we can achieve the same results in a temporary fashion. And that's essentially what we were doing.
Does CRISPR affect the sex or the sex genetics? Like, so basically we did target all parts of the body, even the reproductive organs.
Yeah. So there's a couple different ways to answer that. Generally speaking, CRISPR can be used really in any tissue. And in many cases with genetic problems, you know, a lot of times you only need to target a particular tissue. So in the case of muscular dystrophy, really all we're worried about is muscle tissue, right? We wouldn't necessarily need to target skin tissue. But the way that you go about introducing a CRISPR technique kind of varies. And what I'll tell you is, and this is one of the challenges, is if you are dealing with a mature person or organism and you're trying to introduce a CRISPR technique, again, it is very powerful, but the trouble is getting it introduced systemically, right? So meaning all across all tissues, all cells. it's a challenge. Typically, we try to do that with things like viral vectors. And there's actually a COVID vaccine that uses a viral vector. And we use one of the more common viral vectors that we'll use is called an AAV or an adenovirus. Adenoviruses in humans have been interacting for a very long time, and we know volumes about them. They're generally safe to use, and they tend to have a systemic effect. But again, it kind of depends on how you introduce it. Are you injecting it? A lot of times, even if you inject it into a particular tissue, it's only going to propagate so far before, you know, it's sort of localized in an area. So the point is that although the technology itself is really powerful, it's actually kind of difficult to get the CRISPR payload into all tissues all at once. A more powerful technique, and this is where you start running into ethical dilemmas, is to do the CRISPR technique at the blastocyst stage. So when you're a single or just a few cells big, then you can literally inject the CRISPR payload into each individual cell that you want. And then the outcome is a systemic effect on the whole organism. Again, there's ethical dilemmas there. So we're still, at least in the US, we're treading very carefully in that space.
Cool. So we're just going to go back to your, people probably don't believe that you're actually with a ranger, because you're talking about this high level science, and it's revolutionarily world leading science. You know, even you've got a lot of mentors, it is crazily powerful. When I was back at university, 2003 and 2004, none of the stuff was on the table. So this is unheard of for, like, back in my day. I sound like an old fuddy-duddy here, but we're almost the same age. But, you know, I've got 10 years software development, you've got 10 years being a ranger. So can you just maybe just go through your military history before we get back to this and share what you can share? Maybe share a couple of stories on the field if you can, and how you went into biology.
Sure. So I think, I mean, I definitely recognize that I'm sort of a weird collection of skills. I guess this story really starts in college. I always had a proclivity for engineering. I like having a method to solve problems, and engineering really gives you a lot of tools to do that, because it incorporates stuff that are just hard truths about, you know, regarding physics or math, things that are, you know, not really fallible in many ways. So it gives you just sort of a real solid tool set and then to then go out into the world and solve problems. And that's a particular reason why I like engineering. You know, if, for example, theoretical physics, you know, they stay in the world of the abstract or the theorized. And there's a lot to be said about that. There's a reason why we have that discipline. But the thing that I think that separates engineers from others is that we're solidly grounded in the practical. All, you know, we really care about is the practical application of the technology. So I really love that about engineering. I've always been drawn to engineering for that way. And so I guess my story starts in college. You know, I went to a university called University of North Florida in Jacksonville, Florida. You know, I'm from Florida, so. It kind of just, you know, there was no real reason why I chose that. There was an ROTC unit that's there, and, you know, that was when I was first exploring the military side. And so that was part of the reason I went there. But I actually knew about the idea of bioengineering back then. Unfortunately, UNF didn't provide it then. So I decided to explore civil engineering, which is all about building structures, infrastructure, wastewater systems, water systems, that type of stuff. And so that's where my engineering kind of foundation began. And then while I was in the ROTC unit, I was able to secure a slot to go to BUDS, and so which set me on my journey in the military world. So, you know, there's plenty of movies and books on BUDS now. I won't go into too much of the detail, but I will say that it was one of the more challenging things I've ever done in my life. You know, I think the first kind of milestone in BUDS, the first milestone in BUDS is to get to BUDS. It's so competitive now, especially for someone like me at the time who was an officer, it's even more competitive for them.
Why is that?
Just because, so I'm going to have to use old numbers. I'm not sure if this is still the case, but when I was going in, there was only 83 available slots per year for officers. So there's a ton of officers across the nation who are all vying for these 83 slots, and about half of them go to the NEOL Academy. So for the rest of us out in the ROTC and OCS world, we're competing for about 40 slots. And to be competitive, it has a lot to do with your education, which is another reason why I chose civil engineering. Has to do with your recommendations, your PT scores, some of your community service, and so on and so forth. So it takes a lot to be competitive to get a slot. But I was lucky. I got a slot, which kind of started me on my path. So once you get there, you kind of get put in something called NDOC for a while, and then you start with your class. And I started with class 276 originally. And sort of the first milestone is Hell Week. And Hell Week is the one where they made, you know, the Discovery Channel shows about you stay awake for 5 days straight, 120 hours of pure just getting after it. So I was able, you know, I made it through all that. I did recycle once, but I ended up finishing Hell Week with class 277 and moved on to second phase. So my preparation to go to Buzz was really physical. I mean, it was all really physically paced. I thought that I was, you know, mentally pretty capable just naturally. But what I found out, you know, Buzz really exposed a weakness of mine, which was my ability to hold my breath. You know, it's kind of colloquial called micro lungs in Buzz, but long story short, there's many, many training events in Buzz that require you to hold your breath. One's the 50 meter underwater swim, pool comp, underwater knot tying, so on and so forth.
50 meters, that's 50 meters without any air.
It's, you know, it sounds like a lot. And when you look at it, it doesn't seem like that much. But when you're doing it, it does seem like that much.
It's like the full length of an Olympic swimming pool.
I believe so. Yeah, I believe so.
Well, I can do the width, but I can't do, I mean, that for me, a width is hard, but you'd have to build up to that for.
Right. And, you know, and what they don't tell you, you know, everybody kind of knows at this point what the main events are, but what they don't tell you is, you know, the instructors are dropping you down. It's called smoking. You get, you know, tuned up a little bit, have to do push-ups, sit-ups, all this stuff right before you do the event. So you're already kind of out of breath. Mm-hmm. You don't get to just jump in and kick off the wall. You jump in and do a front flip, which disorients you, and then you have to start from kind of stasis. The thing about Buzz is that at least with the events where you have to hold your breath, if you come up to the surface early for any reason, you fail. So, and if you do that, I believe it's twice. It's called an involuntary withdrawal. It's basically another version of quitting. So you only have two choices. You either complete it or you pass out. And in my case, in many instances, I passed out prior to me completing the event, which is a little bit differently. They give you a little bit more leeway because you've obviously demonstrating that you're mentally tough enough to kind of stay underwater until you pass out. Obviously, it's not healthy though. So that happened, I think, five times while I was there. And on the fifth time, it was a little bit, it was more dangerous in that event.
Essentially, you're drowned. You've drowned and someone saved your life.
Yeah, exactly. And then on the fifth time, finally, the dive doctor was like, hey, man, this is, you know, it was like a nice way of saying sorry, you know, like you're going to have
to find something. Basically died five times. You've experienced dying five times. That's
right. And so I was obviously at the time I was younger then, I was super upset about it. But it turned out to be probably one of the biggest blessings in disguises of my life. And the reason is that set me on a different path, right? Like they offered to send me out to the fleet. I still could have stayed in the Navy as an officer and all that, but I just didn't join the Navy for that purpose. So I started exploring how to switch branches. And this is where my story gets a little bit unique. Most people join the military as enlisted, and then some of those people will become officers, or you start the military as an officer and you stay an officer. Very, very, very few, almost none, start as an officer and then go enlisted. You're kind of going backwards. But I'll tell you my rationale. So I did start exploring the special operations community in the Army, and there was a lot of different things that I wanted to do. Ranger Regiment was one of them. And But at the time, the program to switch from the Navy to the Army as an officer was called Blue to Green. And so I started going down that path. And as you know, everything in the military is just a long, drawn out bureaucratic process. So I was in this transition period for like a year and a half. And finally, they came back and they said, hey, Blue to Green is great, but it's not open to O1s and O2s, which I was an O2 at the time. And so I really didn't have a way to get into the Army. So what I did instead, which really blew a lot of people's minds, and I got people looked at me funny, but I resigned my commission. So I officially resigned my commission and then went into the Army as an enlisted guy, and they couldn't stop me from doing that. So that's what I did, joined the Army as an enlisted guy. One of the other things I learned while I was in the Navy is, although there's a ton of perks to being an officer and they're vitally important in many, many ways, what you find out is that the officers really aren't the ones doing the job. You know, and by the job, I mean the guy who's kicking the door in. That's not their job. Their job is to be a manager, you know, in the battle space. And their operational time is pretty limited because of that. So once I learned that, then I felt a lot better about going the enlisted route, because I knew, you know, I was going to be doing what I wanted to do, which was to do the job. So anyways, that ended up landing me at Ranger Regiment. I was there for about 8 years. So the 75th Ranger Regiment is the Army's premier light infantry brigade force. They have really grown to some degree of fame in the special operations community over the last years in Afghanistan. The Ranger Regiment pretty much dominates all of the op tempo in the Middle East right now. And they've turned out to be an amazing organization. And I learned so much there. I got to do exactly what I thought I was going to be doing. It was a dream come true. Like, some people get out of the military and they talk about how much the military sucked. That was not my experience at all. I had an amazing time. I met amazing people, brilliant people, strong people, insightful people, you know, and they're all hard as nails. And we all did, you know, did our deployments together. I deployed 3 times myself. And we just got it done overseas. I wouldn't have wanted to do it with any other group of guys. That includes SEALs, SF guys. No offense if you're listening. Rangers is who I would have done it with. So I really consider what happened in Buds, although it was not, I didn't feel good about it at the time, it was a blessing in disguise. So that kind of brings me to the end of my story in the military, which is I made it to about the 10-year mark. And at the 10-year mark, that's when you're, like, when you re-enlist after the 10-year mark, that's usually when you're thinking about what's called an indefinite re-enlistment. So that's kind of your final one, which is in a lot of ways, you're basically agreeing to yourself that you're going to stay in for 20. So it's a big crossroads moment. And I had been lucky in my career. I had got to do the things that I really wanted to do. I did them safely, and I felt like it was a good time. If I was going to pick any time, it was a good time to kind of hang up the hat and explore some other options. And, you know, prior to my civil engineering days, I really was intrigued by bioengineering. And so I started exploring that at UCSD here in San Diego, California. And as luck would have it, I applied and I got in. So for me, that was kind of the moment where I took a different path. And so I left the military with a positive attitude, loved it, will always cherish it, but it was time to go on a new adventure. And that sort of starts my story as a bioengineer. So at the end of the day, I'm a sort of a weird collection of skills, but I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but it is a thing.
I've never heard anyone in the world that did the Army to that level and did biology. I don't know one soldier who became a scientist personally, but I'm sure there are, as you can see. But how long was it that you were at university and before you were actually in the lab working on cutting edge research?
Yeah, that's, you know, that's another wild thing is I was only there for about a year. So I was doing a master's program, which is generally shorter than your undergrad, right? So the first year was coursework. And then at the beginning of the second year is when you either finish up any coursework that you haven't finished, but the real task is to join a lab and start your thesis. So yeah, it was pretty
much. It blows my mind, man. How do you spend a year? What can you learn in a year of biology? And then you're suddenly thrown into this. I'm a bit jealous, mate. I spent 5 years at university. And I know. It's, you know, crazy, man.
I'll be honest with you. That was probably my greatest concern. And as I was applying
the mic now, man, I've got a bit of the mic.
I definitely, you know, my biggest concern leaving the military and then going into bioengineering. And I talked to the counselors at length about this, which is, you know, two things. You know, I'm apparently joining the number two bioengineering program in the country. And bioengineering at its base is biology, right? In my civil engineering discipline, I don't know if I took a single biology class. And so, and not only that, but that was 10 years ago at that point. So I'm like, hey guys, like, is there anything that any undergrad courses I take, any sort of prep work I need to have for me to be successful here? Because I just really thought I was kind of, it seemed like.
I'm even more shocked. I didn't realize you didn't do an undergraduate program, man.
No, yeah. So it was just, I went straight into a master's program after being a civil engineer for my undergrad. So I was worried about it, to be honest with you. But, you know, I think the way, not that I really have anything to compare it to, but the way that UCSD kind of does business and the quality of professors that they employ really enabled me to learn a lot. And it's a little different in a master's program. You kind of have to do a lot of the learning on your own in many ways. And so I kind of just embraced that mentality. You know, it was kind of the first time in my life that I didn't have anybody telling me what I needed to do. So I had a lot of free time just to dive in as far as I could. And really, I would say that I would have to attribute a lot of my success there to the students who were there with me. You know, I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to fit in with a bunch of 20 somethings, but they were absolutely open to that. My colleagues there were amazing. They helped me a lot along the way. There was a lot of fundamental biology stuff that I just really hadn't any exposure to. And they took the time to kind of walk me through all that stuff. So, in the end, you know, I was able to accomplish at least the foundational level of bioengineering to, you know, lead me into the research realm, which then, you know, led me to some of the discoveries I made and the patent that came out of it. So it was great.
Cool. So we've talked about some science. We've talked about your time in the military. Now let's talk about some of the, well, all my echo chamber on LinkedIn are wanting me to ask some difficult questions now, which are probably, well, it is what it is. So my biggest issue now is that half the UK is vaccinated and probably most of the most vulnerable people have been targeted first with the vaccine. So I'm asking, like, why are we still in lockdown? Why is it worse now in terms of freedoms than it is last year? I want an answer from the government. You can't answer that question, but maybe you've got some insight.
Yeah, I think I have some insight to offer on this. And I think the way that you look at this, to be fair, I think that there's two ways to look at this as the individual, someone like you and me. So if we're looking at it through the lens of an individual on the ground level, obviously it makes no sense to be under lockdown once a certain threshold of people have been vaccinated. So that's from the individual's perspective. But I think that perspective changes when you're in a position where your role is to protect all of your charges, you know, all of your city, all of your state, all of your country. When you're in that role, you can't afford to be risky. And so just to be fair, I do see why someone at the, you know, parliamentary level or the congressional level where I live would be more keen to be more safe. And in many ways, I think we can agree, overly safe. Now, I don't think that there's anything wrong with that on its face. I think what has happened, though, is a almost utter perversion of the narrative by media and social media. And I think in many ways that has to do with the way they do business, right? They don't make money on non-sensational stories. So everything has to be sensational. And I think that that has altered the way that a lot of people think about the topic and has had this strange effect where people are abandoning the 100 years or so of, you know, virology background that we've all known and immunology background that we have all known and accepted. And so now we're seeing things that are people are asking us to do that just simply don't make sense. And I would say, you know, I think in the beginning of this, I mean, this is Tom Morton's own personal opinion. You know, I think in the beginning of this, the mortality rates were overstated. And there's a study out of Stanford that I definitely encourage people to look up that it was in the first few months of the outbreak. And essentially what was happening is they were deriving their mortality rates based on the number of tests, the positive tests that they received. And there's not necessarily anything wrong with that, but that assumes that they're capturing every single person with a test, which is not the case. And so what they basically said is that there's actually 10 to 50 times more people who have been infected with COVID at that time, which then means that the mortality rate is 10 to 50 times lower because it's the denominator, right? So it's lower. So when you start doing that math, then all of a sudden now you're looking at a mortality rate that's a little bit closer to the flu. And then you start asking the questions, well, what we did right? And I think it's reasonable to have that discussion. I will say though, that if I were to put myself in the position of a policymaker, I would err on the side of caution, because if my data is wrong or I'm too cavalier, then a lot of people could die. I think so that's kind of my general position on that. But what I would say is that I think what we have not done a good job of is it's really easy to focus on the amount of people that could be killed or negatively impacted by the virus. We have enough data now to kind of talk about that. What we haven't done though is the other downstream effects regarding the economy, job loss, stress, drug use, domestic violence. And I don't think that we've done a good job of taking those variables and putting them into the overall equation to help us determine what the right course of action is. Mm-hmm. So all that being said, I don't really disagree with the way that we handled it up till the vaccine, but I do have some criticisms on what Dr. Fauci and others are saying now, which is they are still really pushing for mask use, social distancing, regardless of the level of immunization, which to me is just not justifiable.
I think that the public are reaching the breaking point now where, I mean, you look at the, we could talk about this for hours. I don't really want to waste your time too much because we can really get a lot of other information that's probably more helpful. But go read my LinkedIn post, people, if you want to find out what other things I'm questioning. But anyway, brilliant answer. Very diplomatic answer as well. You'll be able to write for a paper soon, I think, with that kind of answer. Man, see if I had some of my friends to give an answer like that. You would not believe the language. Would be unbelievable. Make your mum blush, mate. Once I basically says to a friend, he probably listened to this, I says, I took a test. It was like I'd done some sacred, dodgy vow of Satan or something, you know, like it was funny, the reaction, you know, but I didn't see any silver worms coming out of the swab or microchips, you know, so, but I really hate those things going up my nose. I don't want to ever have that feeling again, you know, like nose rate, pretty much what I call it. Anyway, right, back to biology. Right, biology more, let me think. I had a good question there, but, you know, when you get to 36, sometimes you AstraZeneca vaccine, do you know anything about that?
I know generally how it works. It is different from the others.
I've been told that it's actually old technology.
It is. So I'll do my best to describe the differences and kind of, and what I'll say right off the bat is there's pros and cons to each. If you wanted more information on this from someone who might be considered more of an expert, I definitely encourage people to listen to Brett Weinstein and his wife Heather talk about it. They do a really good job of diving into the details on this, but I'll kind of give you the layman's version. So as we kind of described earlier, maybe this is a good opportunity to kind of retouch this a little bit. The Pfizer Moderna vaccines are an mRNA approach. So there's what the mRNA does, which is codes for the spike protein that is naturally present on COVID. Why is that protein important? The protein is important because that is the antigen that your immune system recognizes as a threat. So basically what you're telling your cell to do is to bruise just the part that tells your immune system there's something wrong and nothing else. And in my opinion, that's an ingenious way to go about it. And the other aspect that we really haven't talked about is, remember we were talking a little bit about some of the challenges of CRISPR technologies and introducing them systemically. And there's a lot of reasons why that's a challenge. In the case of what I'm used to, which is using viruses to introduce whatever you're trying to introduce, the problem with that is you really only get one time because your immune system recognizes viral vector, as they're called, as a threat. It neutralizes that threat, and then it builds up defenses in the future. So the next time you're to inject someone with that same viral vector, it would be harder to get a true systemic effect. So that's another technology that was integrated into the mRNA, Pfizer, Moderna vaccine approaches that is new. And what they're using is something called a lipid nanoparticle, LNP for short. And when they're engineered via bioengineers and others, they're sometimes referred to as micelles. And the closest analog in nature are liposomes or exosomes. And liposomes, exosomes, you can think of them as small capsules that their job is to transport nutrients, proteins, whatever, you know, from certain places inside the cytoplasm to the cell membrane and beyond. And their structure is just a lipid bilayer, exactly like our cell membranes are. Just in a smaller package. So what scientists have done is they've recreated those and they call them LNPs. And then inside of the LNPs, they put the mRNA, and that keeps the mRNA safe. It keeps the RNA safe from what are called RNases, which RNases are naturally present in your body. And when RNases interact with RNA, they immediately degrade them. So if you were to just inject someone with mRNA, basically none of it would get to the places it needs to go because of all of the RNAs is present. So what you do is you package them inside the LNP. The LNP keeps it safe. When the LNP interacts with the cell membrane, it's recognized just like a liposome or an exosome, and then brought inside the cell, it deposits its payload, and then it gets to do what it needs to do. Really, really cool stuff. Leveraging some really, you know, now that we know something about it, it seems simple, but some simple yet effective mechanisms to get the immune response that we're after. In the case of the before I move on to AstraZeneca, let me talk about one of the cons. As I mentioned a few times so far in our podcast here, that RNA itself is very unstable. And so as you may have heard, some of the logistical challenges with deploying the vaccines is they have to keep them so cold, and you keep them so cold to prevent spontaneous degradation. So that's the downside of the RNA approach. So that's a good segue to go on over to the AstraZeneca one. Now the AstraZeneca one is more traditional. So their delivery vector is not an LNP, it's a viral vector. And as far as I can tell, they're using a AAV from that is related to chimpanzees. Again, we understand AAVs very well. We know how they work, generally safe. And so that's the delivery vector. And then instead of delivering RNA, they deliver DNA. Now, what they're doing prior to that is they're engineering the AAV's DNA payload to only do specific things. So it's not like they're delivering the DNA that would otherwise start creating more AAVs and get you sick. They've already kind of bioengineered, modified that DNA strand to only do a particular thing. So the AAV gets to the cell membrane, deposits its DNA payload into the cytoplasm, and then the difference here is the DNA payload is transported inside the nucleus. Mm-hmm. Now, here's where people will probably start to get a little bit concerned. You're inside the nucleus. There is many, many, many mechanisms that control the integration or repair of DNA. It is highly unlikely that a random strand of DNA will ever be integrated into your genome. So that's not really a worry. There's so many reasons on why that is the case, but even just the way that the DNA is coiled on itself within the nucleus prevents some types of integration. Mm. So I won't go too much into that. All I'll say is, although you are getting an exogenous DNA into your nucleus, which is proximal to your natural DNA, it is not being integrated into your genome. I can't say that enough. So once the DNA is now in your nucleus, now the same process that happens in nature happens. RNA polymerase interacts with your DNA, generates a messenger RNA. The messenger mRNA is brought out to the cytoplasm. That now created mRNA basically is exactly what we were just directly introducing in the other models. It interacts with the ribosome and it creates the spike protein. You get the same exact effect that the other vaccines are giving. Now, some cons, interesting ones, actually. So far, the effectiveness of that approach seems to be less. And my guess is that it's because there's more steps involved. And so you can expect some losses at each one of these steps. So because it takes more steps to get to kind of the same outcome in the AstraZeneca model, I think that gives more opportunities for things to go wrong. And so we're seeing a little bit of a reduction in effectiveness. What's really interesting though, is they came onto this by accident. I believe it was Britain or Brazil, I forget which now. They made an error, a sort of serendipitous error, and they only gave some of their trial group half the dose. And in the cases where they only gave them half the dose, then they had 90% effectiveness, which is pretty much in line with the other two. And what's interesting about that is that unlike the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, because the payload is DNA and it's in a viral vector, you essentially only have to keep it at not room temperature, but the temperatures that are easy to achieve and transport. It's cold, but not negative 80 degrees Celsius. So they're much more stable. And so if we have a method that and here's the other kind of thing that's good about it, is we have studied this type of vaccine for so long. We have a lot of data to back up what the downstream effects and any of the problems. So we're not really in uncharted territory with this. It's more stable, easier to transport, and cheaper. So AstraZeneca has agreed to not make any profits during the pandemic, so it's cheaper. And its effectiveness, we're still figuring this out, but it appears its effectiveness is capable of being in line with the other ones. So although I do think that the other ones represent new tech that's really interesting and probably is going to be the way of the future, until we get an opportunity to do the actual process to do all the phase trials at their proper lengths, I would be more apt to take the AstraZeneca vaccine because we know it. We're not in uncharted territory with that one. With the mRNA stuff, we are a bit in uncharted territory. But that being said, I want to stress this, based on my understanding of the tech, I do think it's safe and it will end up being shown to be safe in long-term studies.
Okay, so thanks for that. For me, when people say that AstraZeneca is old tech, for me, it's like all the risks of the mRNA plus this DNA that's going into your into your nucleus. So in a sense, you've got one vaccine that's just the mRNA, mm-hmm. and you've got this other vaccine, which people call old, which is old and safe, but you're getting DNA plus mRNA. So for me, that's twice the problems that can potentially happen.
Yeah, so I don't think, I think you're right in to say that there's issues with both, right? I think at this point, our data suggests that the DNA being transported into the nucleus has been proven not to integrate with our genomes. So that's one thing. We have proven at this point that the AAV viral vectors are safe. And we understand this process. We've got a lot of data to suggest the general safety of that technique. The fact that the DNA ends up resulting in an mRNA that produces a protein is not really the dangerous part, in my opinion.
What's the difference between that and the Pfizer thing? Pfizer is just skipping the middleman.
It is
using an analytic particle.
And I do think that that's a pro. However, in my opinion, I don't think that mRNAs on their own are unsafe. We have hundreds of thousands of mRNAs per cell that are constantly interacting with ribosomes. The molecule itself is not unsafe.
I don't see how it could be any more unsafe than the AstraZeneca one, given that the AstraZeneca one has the same product, right? I mean, just same RNA that comes out.
Well, the difference, in my opinion, the main difference, other than the pathways in which they get to the same result, is the delivery vector. So we really don't have a lot of data, long-term studies on the use of LNPs as a delivery vector. In my mind, they seem safe because they're really just a man-made liposome. So there should be no danger. I mean, so, but we don't work with shoulds in science, right? We want to have no's. So we don't know yet because we haven't done a lot of long-term studies on that delivery vector. I do think that, you know, one thing that I wish we had more information on, again, let me preface this by saying, I don't think it's going to end up being a real issue, but one thing I would like to know more about is, you know, as we're sitting here now, our body is doing its best to keep us in a homeostatic range. And I know I've seen some of the comments from your page that kind of address this, but anytime we're essentially hijacking or encouraging the cell to make a particular protein for a particular purpose, we are at least taking a portion of the cell's ability to make proteins away to make a protein that we want to make that really has nothing to do with homeostasis. Now, many will say that the cells have an ability to upregulate or downregulate protein production, in a big way. But I mean, just as a, from an engineering, you know, just thinking about thermodynamics and entropy, everything, every mechanism has a finite maximum. So I don't, as far as I can tell, I don't think that anybody's really established what that is. So I'd just like to know. I mean, I simply, this type of information would be revealed if we didn't do warp speed. And it would be good to know what that is, you know. And I do think that there's something going on because people are having some ill effects with the vaccines, typically on the second dose. They're not severe, but I think we should, as a science community or just a community, do the due diligence to figure out why that is.
Yeah, I mean, man, we could still talk so long on this stuff, but that's a really great answer. Okay, senior moment time. So one of the, I'm going to be Joe Public again, and because, you know, I'm genuinely worried about this. So the way that we are being pressured to take these vaccines, I mean, if the politicians and scientists would talk about this like you did, right, at the very, very start about the vaccine, had people like Joe Public got injections, and if they had basically says, we're going to give this vaccine to the old people at risk, you know, I personally, my granddad died before he had the vaccine, so I wish he had the vaccine, honestly, And another friend of mine, I knew, died today in America. I hadn't been touched him, but he was like 60 years, a lawyer. And I found out he's dead. I don't even know if he took the vaccine or not. Gutted. If the government had just been like, yeah, we're going to give this vaccine to the old people and people at risk, they'll get it first. And as soon as we give them, these people, the vaccine, lockdown's lifted, right? I'd be like, sure, no problem, get the vaccine. But the fact that we have this political system around these vaccines makes me doubt what the act. And then so many other people as well are saying, what is in these vaccines? Because it's the way the governments are behaving. And look at Israel. I mean, why is Israel under lockdown right now? And why do we need vaccine passports? To protect who? Give the old people the vaccine. Done. You know, if you want to get a vaccine, optional. You know, it's this whole thing around it that makes what would be just by talking to you. If I was just talking to you without all the pressure to take these vaccines, I would think, yes, this doesn't sound that bad, you know, from my own biology. But it's the biology I know, plus what I'm seeing with the governments. And the governments don't seem to be listening to the people right now. I mean, and the media does not want to report on the thing happened this weekend with the massive protest. One of the papers, I think it was Sky, forgive me if I'm wrong, says hundreds of people in London are protesting. There were 100,000 people there almost, if you've seen some of the long view things of this thing. So this is what is either the media and the governments are making a really bad PR problem, or we are the conspiracy theories are right and this is a takeover.
Yeah,
I don't see any other options. I hope it's the first one, because I want to live my life in peace. You know, I don't want to have to.
There's a lot to unpack here, but I want to try to unpack it as much as I can, because I think this is important. And I think that both sides have done things that are not helping the solution. And by the both sides, I mean really everybody involved, you know, the people like us and then the policymakers. So I agree with you that the way the government is behaving seems like there's something strange going on. I agree with that. But the more and more I look at it, the more and more I realize that they're acting the way that they're acting for political ends, to gain favor with certain groups of people, to kind of dance the dance for the media narrative. And we have already discussed that the media really has no reason to tell the truth anymore, because the only thing that sells is sensationalism. And so I think that those two things together are like this weird negative feedback loop that just ends up resulting in stranger and stranger behavior. And then us, who are outside of that sort of cyclone of chaos, we're just sitting here looking through our lens, looking at their behavior, and we are confused because it doesn't line up with common sense. And so our first inclination is to go down the path of conspiracy theory. I will say that I am typically very resistant to conspiracy theories, and here's why, is that I want to put any conspiracy theory through the ringer first. I want to ask all the tough questions. I want to make people explain it and show me data and tell me why. Because when you think about the conspiracy theories that are coming out, they are so diabolical that if it turns out to be true, I want to make sure I'm right. And that is where we have messed up as a general population, is we have run with these things without asking the hard questions, and then they get debunked and we look like the idiots, right? And so that's part of what I'm trying to do here today, is get the right information out there so we all have a good foundation, we know what the right questions are to ask, and then we can do like kind of what Project Veritas does in America. They expose things that they know to be true. They're not chasing dragons.
Project Veritas, look at that.
Yeah, they're a great, I mean, they have their own sort of provocateur at their head, but, you know, they really haven't been wrong yet. I'll put it to you that way. I think there's two forces at play. I do agree that many of the policies coming out of the politicians don't seem right. They don't seem to align with common sense. I will be the first one to tell you that I agree with you. Once we get enough people vaccinated to reach, you know, the threshold, some call it herd immunity, where a virus really can't propagate any more dangerously, then the lockdowns need to be lifted.
We're running out of time, my friend. People are going crazy. People are losing their... I have people on LinkedIn asking me for money, right? People like, you look at their profile, they're high performance. Like, you think they're millionaires. People like to keep a nice face until they're about to lose their house and their family's on the line, their children, okay?
I agree.
We don't have much time. This could go powder keg, right? This people are very angry. I have people on LinkedIn messaging me, professionals. Like, yeah. They don't want to say anything because they're professional, because they want to come against the narrative, you know? I have people messaging me, and they've got clients who don't want to lose business, but they're really, really angry. Okay, so I don't know what this is, I'm not enough energy, you know, because like sometimes
I get
200 times more engagement when I post about vaccines and COVID than I do on business, you know.
Yeah, I know. And again I think our role, if our intention is to have a peaceful resolution, then our job is to get the right information to the right people that can get into the ears of the policymakers and change the narrative, right? We need to get to a point where our collective voice is the first, and I cannot stress this enough, our collective voice doesn't mean anything if we are focused on falsities. We have to make sure that our voice is right first, factual, hard truth, can't dispute it. And then we join together and we create a collective. And then we use that collective to start pressuring our policymakers. In my country, that's Fauci. I think Fauci is, again, I as I stated before, I understand the stance that he took in the beginning, but to tell us that now in the midst of 40% of the population being vaccinated, that we should be wearing now two masks and continue to social distance, he calls himself he refers to himself as an expert, but that goes against the very foundation of immunology. And so, and I can tell, at least I can't tell, I perceive that he is being pressured to take a certain stance, and that's where we come in with our collective voice. But the first thing we have to do is make sure that we are coming from a place of knowledge, indisputable fact. And that's I think that's where we vary.
And I think that you are important because you have a voice to the army. A lot of people respect who you are. I think your unique qualification is fantastic, you know. And to hear your answers, I really hope that your voice gets to the people that can make decisions, you know, because you know I want to live a life in peace and quiet, you know. And
me too, man.
Sometimes I get into dark places, you know, with this what's going on, you know, and yeah, mate. I don't really have any more questions right now, but I'm sure we can do another podcast if you want some more time.
Yeah, absolutely, man. No, this has been good. I love to talk about it. You're a great host. I think we explored some important stuff, and you know, maybe your listeners will help generate some new questions for us to explore next time.
Okay, well, that was Tom Morton on my show. I don't even like calling it the Nikos Katsikanis show because it feels so, oh, the Nikos Katsikanis show. That's why I had the two other podcasts, The Larynthos and Infantis Cafe, but, you know, I combined them both to basically, I didn't have time to do them both properly. I could if I was doing them full-time and sponsored, but I can't. So, okay, so this was really helpful, and, you know, I really hope people will listen to this and get the word out there and somehow this will contribute to the butterfly effect of we having our freedoms back and businesses back, you know. So thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
See ya.